says Yahweh, for three transgressions of Damascus and for four, I will not turn away its punishment, because they have threshed Gilead with implements of iron. But I will send a fire into the house of Hazael, which shall devour the palaces of Ben-Hadad. I will also break the gate bar of Damascus and cut off the inhabitant from the valley of Avon and the one who holds the scepter from Beth Eden. The people of Syria shall go captive to Kir, says Yahweh. Thus says Yahweh, for three transgressions of Gaza and for four, I will not turn away its punishment, because they took captive the whole captivity to deliver them up to Edom. But I will send a fire upon the wall of Gaza, which shall devour its palaces. I will cut off the inhabitant from Ashdod, and the one who holds the scepter from Ashkelon. I will turn my hand against Ekron, and the remnant of the Philistines shall perish, says the Lord Yahweh. Thus says Yahweh, for three transgressions of Tyre, and for four, I will not turn away its punishment, because they delivered up the whole captivity to Edom and did not remember the covenant of brotherhood. But I will send a fire upon the wall of Tyre, which shall devour its palaces. Thus says Yahweh, for three transgressions of Edom and for four, I will not turn away its punishment, because he pursued his brother with the sword and cast off all pity. His anger tore perpetually, and he kept his wrath forever. But I will send a fire upon Teman, which shall devour the palaces of Bozrah. Thus says Yahweh, for three transgressions of the people of Ammon, and for four, I will not turn away its punishment, because they ripped open the women with child in Gilead, that they might enlarge their territory. But I will kindle a fire in the wall of Rabbah, and I shall devour its palaces, amid shouting in the day of battle, and a tempest in the day of the whirlwind. Their king shall go into captivity, he and his princes together, says Yahweh. Thus says Yahweh, for three transgressions of Moab and for four, I will not turn away its punishment, because he burned the bones of the king of Edom to lime. But I will send a fire upon Moab, and it shall devour the palaces of Kerioth. Moab shall die with tumult, with shouting and trumpet sound, and I will cut off the judge from its midst and slay all its princes with him, says Yahweh. This is the word of the Lord. Please be seated. Last week we met Amos, a sheep herder in Judah turned prophet to Israel. It is clear from the opening verses of the book that judgment will be a key theme of Amos's prophecy. We read, Yahweh roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem. The pastures of the shepherds mourn, and the top of Carmel withers. Carmel is a geographical reference within the northern kingdom of Israel, and the prophecy of Amos is directed primarily to that kingdom. But it is not exclusively so directed. In Psalm 24:1, David declares, "The earth is Yahweh's and all its fullness, the world and those that dwell therein." Unlike the gods of the nations round about, Yahweh was not just the national god of one nation or people. The earth is Yahweh's, and not just part of the earth, but all its fullness. And he possesses not just geography, but people as well, the world and those who dwell therein. To be sure, Yahweh has a special relationship with the descendants of Jacob, the 12 tribes of Israel that now in the time of Amos are divided into two kingdoms. He has bound them into covenant relationship with himself and sends his prophet to bring covenant lawsuits against both Judah and Israel. But because Yahweh is God over all the nations, his prophets sometimes speak to them as well. And that is what we see in this portion of Amos, which I've entitled, Yahweh Roars Against the Gentile Nations. Remember that verse earlier on, Yahweh roars from Zion. But how can Yahweh speak in judgment against nations who have not received his law directly from his hand as Israel had? Is that fair? Well, we can say a few things about that. First, as we saw in Psalm 24, Yahweh owns all nations and their inhabitants because he has created them. His authority over them is absolute. And secondly, all people have an innate sense of morality that they either live by or transgress. Listen to how Paul explains this in Romans 2, verses 14 and 15. When the Gentiles who do not have the law, now that's the Mosaic law, by nature do the things in the law, these also, though not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves their thoughts accusing or else excusing them. Our doctrine of total depravity tells us that even the conscience has been twisted by sin, but it has not been totally eradicated. People still have a sense of right and wrong. There's enough remnant of the law written on the human heart that all people and nations are responsible to obey it and are subject to judgment for disobeying it. So we might say that the nations are not being judged by what they didn't have, that was the Mosaic law revealed on Mount Sinai, but by what they did have, which was the law written on their hearts. Now, we don't want to pit these two against each other because they are totally in sync. They both reflect the character of God. And there were many aspects of the Mosaic law that were unique to Israel. So, for instance, these nations are not going to be judged because they didn't observe the dietary laws of Israel, but because they didn't observe the worship commandments that were unique to Israel. But no individual or nation can justly declare that Yahweh, who created him and including within him that innate moral sense in his image, no one can declare that Yahweh is not fair in speaking judgment against them. And it is such judgment that we read about in the passage before us. The structure of our message is simply going to follow the structure of the passage, which is built around six statements of judgment against six Gentile nations. And as we examine some of the specifics of these declarations of judgment, we will extract general principles that will help us understand how this passage speaks to nations in our day, as well as to those nations of old. For Yahweh is still God of all the earth, and nations are still morally accountable to him. So we begin our examination of Yahweh's roar against the nations with the roar against Syria. That's in verses 3 through 5 of chapter 1. Thus says Yahweh, for three transgressions of Damascus and for four, I will not turn away its punishment, because they have threshed Gilead with implements of iron. But I will send a fire into the house of Hazael, which shall devour the palaces of Ben-Hadad. I will also break the gate bar of Damascus and cut off the inhabitant from the valley of Avon. And the one who holds the scepter from Beth Eden, the people of Syria, shall go captive to Kir. Thus says Yahweh. Now this is spoken against Syria. It says there Damascus. Damascus is the capital city of Syria. It begins, thus says Yahweh. Now, if you look through the passage, or if you recall from having just heard it, these are the opening words in each statement of judgment. This is what the prophet declares. Amos declares, thus says the Lord, thus says Yahweh. And what this communicates is that his is not merely a human message. This is not something that Amos himself has thought up, you know, being in the southern kingdom, maybe having some antipathy to those in the north, that he's going to come up with some human message. This is divine prophecy from God, the God over all the nations. And then each time we'll also see this phrase, for three transgressions and for four. And sometimes in Hebrew, these sort of expressions develop. It symbolizes a multiplicity of sins. This is not just one sin that's been committed. There's a multiplicity of sins, whether they're listed or not. It may even have a hint of the patience of the Lord. For not just three sins, but for four. In other words, there was a time when that sinning was taking place and yet judgment had not yet been pronounced. We can think about how the Lord spoke about the sin of the Amorites not yet coming to its fullness. There was a time of patience with them until ultimately judgment came through the Lord's people. Well, such is the case here. The judgment is coming on these nations for specific acts. We've already mentioned that Damascus was the capital of Syria. If you see, I put the map again on the back of your handout. It'll probably be helpful today. If you look up in the top right quadrant, you'll see Syria, and you'll see Damascus there. Syria is bigger, extends beyond the borders of the map, but you'll see it's to the north and to the east of the northern kingdom of Israel, where this prophecy is being proclaimed. Now we read, because they threshed Gilead with implements of iron, I will send fire into the house of Hazael. And this refers back to Syria's treatment of Israel in the days of Elisha. In 2 Kings 8, we read the story of Elisha the prophet going to Damascus, there in Syria. He goes to Damascus to confront the Syrian king Ben-Hadad, who is sick. And one of the king's subjects named Hazael comes out to the prophet and asks the prophet whether the king is going to get better. And Elisha says, tell him he's going to recover. And then he says, but I tell you, he's not going to recover. And Elisha is weeping, and Hazael asks, well, why are you weeping? And he says that, well, he says that Hazael is going to actually replace the king on the throne. And then he says, this is why Elisha is weeping. He says, because I know the evil you will do to the children of Israel. Their strongholds you will set on fire, and their young men you will kill with the sword, and you will dash their children and rip open their women with child. 2 Kings 8:12. And the historical sequel shows that Hazael almost immediately assassinated the king and ultimately attacked Israel and gained control of most of Palestine. And the barbarity of his tactics is reflected in the statement here in Amos 1:3. They have threshed Gilead with implements of iron. Now the reference here is to instruments that were used in threshing grain. One commentator explains it this way, a term for a type of threshing board with knives or sharp stones underneath. This board was approximately 7 feet by 3 feet and is used for threshing grain. As the driver stands on it, a young ox pulls it around the threshing floor, thus separating the grain from the chaff. So this was an instrument that was used for a very good purpose of separating chaff from grain in the threshing house. But here, the reference is not to threshing grain. The language here suggests that the Syrians literally rode over the defeated Israelites with threshing boards, an atrocity comparable to the Assyrian practice of impaling and skinning alive, of which the Assyrians were guilty. And it is in judgment against such barbarous torture that Yahweh will act against the house of Hazael, the palaces of Ben-Hadad. Ben-Hadad was the son and the successor of Hazael. The gate bar of Damascus, that would be the gate barring the capital city, which meant that that city would be overrun. The inhabitant of the valley of Avon, which is in the east, the one who holds the scepter from Beth Eden, that's in the west. Again, this is what it's called in Hebrew poetics, a merism. The east to the west means everything, everything in between, from east to west. It's a portrait of total judgment on Syria, eventuating an exile. The people of Syria shall go captive to Kir. Now, of what was Syria guilty that she deserved such devastating divine punishment? Well, in each one of these cases, what we're going to try to do is look at the specific cause for judgment and then reduce it to some sort of general principle. And I've drawn a lot of these from one of my professors, Ralph Davis. The threshing imagery points to a general attitude, and that is that people can be treated like things, and terror is educational. People can be treated like things, terror is educational. really teach them by threshing them like that. Now, we've looked fairly closely at the judgment against Syria. We're not going to spend as much time on the details. I wanted to go through that to show how each portion is there. It's identifying the nations and identifying their specific sin, and it gives some very specifics about judgment. We're going to focus primarily now on the nations and their sins, not elaborating too much on the judgments, though we will read them and refer to them. Secondly, we come to the roar against Philistia, verses 6 through 8. Thus says Yahweh, "For three transgressions of Gaza and for four, I will not turn away its punishment, because they took captive the whole captivity to deliver them up to Edom. But I will send a fire upon the wall of Gaza, which shall devour its palaces. I will cut off the inhabitant from Ashdod and the one who holds the scepter from Ashkelon. I will turn my hand against Ekron, and the remnant of the Philistines shall perish, says the Lord Yahweh." Now again, if you look at your map, on the lower left-hand corner, you'll see that strip along the Mediterranean that's identified as Philistia, and you'll see right in the center of Philistia, the city of Gaza. And that's a city you still hear about today. You hear about the Gaza Strip, a place of great conflict in the Middle East. And we're told that judgment comes upon Philistia because they took captive the whole captivity to deliver them up to Edom. Now you see, Gaza, Philistia is there. It's located on the Mediterranean Sea. It was a major city, a major region for trade, north and south and out across the sea. And specifically, it was that for slave trade. And that's the reference to taking captivity, the whole captive, to deliver them up to Edom. A commentator, Gary V. Smith, explains, "The guilt of Gaza must be related to its forcible dislocation of complete masses of captives for the purposes of economic gain. Their kidnapping of entire villages was probably not the result of war. They made slave raids to satisfy their desire for wealth. Removal by kidnapping for the sole purpose of resale is contrary to even the lowest sense of morality. People are not things. Rather, they are creations of God." And it is because of this activity, this slave trade in people for profit, that the judgment described in verses 7 through 8 will come upon Philistia. So our second region here is Philistia, Gaza. And the attitude there is that people are for profit. To be used. People are for profit. To be used. That brings us to the roar against Phoenicia, verses 9 and 10. Thus says Yahweh, "For three transgressions of Tyre and for four, I will not turn away its punishment, because they delivered up the whole captivity to Edom and did not remember the covenant of brotherhood. But I will send a fire upon the wall of Tyre, which shall devour its palaces." Now again, if you look at your map, if you just go north of Philistia, you'll see a coastal portion of Israel, and then north of that, Phoenicia, and there you see the city of Tyre. Tyre was a major commercial port city on the Mediterranean within Phoenicia. Now we're told they delivered up the whole captivity to Edom. Like Philistia, they are involved in the slave trade. But Phoenicia has an additional mark against it. We're told they did not remember the covenant of brotherhood. Tyre had long had a close relationship with Israel. You may recall that David and Solomon contracted with Hiram of Tyre to obtain building materials, great wood and other building materials, and skilled laborers for the temple. The sin of Tyre and Phoenicia was not just slave trading, but also breaking covenant. And it is for this that the judgment of verse 10 will come upon them. So we have Phoenicia, especially the city of Tyre, and their attitude is obligations don't matter. obligations don't matter. They broke their covenant of brotherhood. That brings us now to the roar against Edom. Verses 11 and 12, thus says Yahweh, "For three transgressions of Edom and for four, I will not turn away its punishment, because he pursued his brother with the sword and cast off all pity. His anger tore perpetually, and he kept his wrath forever. But I will send a fire upon Teman, which shall devour the palaces of Bozra." Again, if you look at your map, you will see below Moab. We just did Moab, right? Did we do? We didn't do Moab. Okay, not Moab yet. But you'll see Edom there in the lower right-hand quarter. The city of Teman is identified there. Edom descended from Esau, and there was long-standing bitterness and anger toward the nation descended from Jacob, that is Israel. Between Edom and Israel, which goes all the way back to the brothers of Jacob and Esau, there had been long-standing conflict. We could say that brotherly love did not characterize Edom's attitudes and actions, which amounted to racial prejudice against Israel. We read, "He pursued his brother with the sword and cast off all pity. His anger tore perpetually, and he kept his wrath forever." And here it's largely attitudes that are in view. He had no pity, had perpetual anger, had eternal wrath. And for these attitudes, they are going to be on the receiving end of the judgment described in verse 12. And so Edom, believe that attitudes can't be judged. And while that sometimes is the case in courts of human justice, it is not the case in divine justice. Attitudes like their prejudice against Israel, they thought, cannot be judged. Then we come to the roar against Ammon in verses 13 through 15. Thus says Yahweh, "For three transgressions of the people of Ammon, and for four, I will not turn away its punishment, because they ripped open the women with child in Gilead, that they might enlarge their territory. But I will kindle a fire in the wall of Rabbah, and it shall devour its palaces, amid shouting in the day of battle, and a tempest in the day of the whirlwind. Their king shall go into captivity, he and his princes together," says Yahweh. Now, Ammon came from the descendants of Lot. And we are told, rather graphically, they ripped open the women with child in Gilead that they might enlarge their territory. Gilead is a city within Israel. The commentator Gordon Keddy writes, "In the effort to enlarge her borders, Ammon slaughtered whole populations, a fact signalized by the murder of mothers and their unborn children." This is imperialistic genocide. It's genocide just to expand the borders of the country. And for this, they are going to receive the judgments announced in verses 14 and 15. And so, Ammon had the attitude, cruelty can be justified. That brings us to the roar against Moab, chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. Thus says Yahweh, "For three transgressions of Moab and for four, I will not turn away its punishment, because he burned the bones of the king of Edom to lime. But I will send a fire upon Moab, and it shall devour the palaces of Kirioth. Moab shall die with tumult, with shouting and trumpet sound. And I will cut off the judge from its midst and slay all its princes with him," says Yahweh. Now Moab were descendants from Lot's youngest daughter. Their great transgression was, we read, he burned the bones of the king of Edom to lime. And what this means is that they dug up the bones of their old enemy and they burned them for sheer spite. That was their great transgression. If Ammon was sinning against the future by murdering pregnant women and their unborn children, Moab was sinning against the past by desecrating the bones of their enemy. Note that while the sins of the other nations all are in some way related to Israel, Moab's sin is that of one pagan nation against another pagan nation, which reminds us that Yahweh judges even such acts, not only acts against the nation of Israel, but acts of one pagan nation against the other. Why? Because the whole earth is his. He cares about all of it. And for this sin of barbaric desecration of the dead, Moab would bear the judgment described in verses 2 and 3. So we have Moab, who had the attitude, hatred, need not cease. I mean, they had defeated this enemy, they had buried the king, and they dug up his bones just to desecrate them because of that old, long-standing hatred that they just wouldn't let go of. So here's some of these attitudes evinced by these nations that came under divine judgment. Syria, people can be treated like things. Terror can be educational. Philistia, people are for profit to be used. Phoenicia, obligations don't matter. Edom, attitudes can't be judged. That includes things like racial prejudice. Ammon, cruelty can be justified. Moab, hatred need not cease. Now, so far, Amos' original audience was likely cheering his message. Why was that? Because this judgment was being announced by all their enemies, all the nations round about that were threats to them. So thus far, they're probably cheering Amos on. They like this guy. Now, we're going to see next week that their cheering probably isn't going to last. But I don't want to wait a week lest we find ourselves cheering and viewing these prophetic judgments as applicable only to those that we would deem our enemies today. And so I want to consider these six attitudes in light of application today. These were spoken of pagan nations, so I want us to think about them in light of a pagan nation, the one that we're citizens of. All right? We're citizens of a nation that at best can be called post-Christian. One could argue it never was really solidly Christian, but certainly has a great Christian heritage that has influenced us and from which we derive much blessing, but we're certainly a post-Christian nation today. And so I would ask of our nation, would it be guilty of these things? If an Amos were to stand among us today, would we be guilty at times of treating people like things? Well, we don't use threshing implements in our torture, but we have been guilty of torture. We justify it, but we think it's kind of educational sometimes. How about people being used for profit? Now, we know that, you know, all around the world, there's the horrible reality of a literal slave trade that continues to go on in sex trafficking. That's certainly not something that we endorse in our nation, and so we can be glad of that, but it's a reality that still goes on. But we have to wonder, are people used for profit maybe in broader ways? I mean, might it possibly be the case that in some large corporations, the employees are simply pawns for profit, being used not as a way to really honor who they are, but to gain profit for those who are above them? Or how about obligations don't matter? Is it the case sometimes that promises are broken to make a buck or to advance self-interest? Do we sort of treat promises and covenants and treaties lightly, because we just want what's best in our own minds today? Perhaps more seriously, how about attitudes? Attitudes like prejudice can't be judged. Do we have problems sometimes with attitudes and prejudice in our nation? I would think that one doesn't have to really ponder that too long to recognize there's an awful lot of rhetoric, especially political rhetoric in our day, that seeks to demonize the other. Whether that other is a racial minority, along a problem in our country, adherents of other religions like Muslims, immigrants, or illegal immigrants, we can sometimes fall into that problem of attitudes, thinking that they can't be judged. How about cruelty can be justified? We've already mentioned the fact that our nation engages in torture, but there's other ways in which cruelty is engaged in, including inhumane treatment of illegal immigrants. This is just a reality in our day sometimes. How about hatred need not cease? Again, we could think of long-standing racial prejudice. This often runs both ways, between different groups or between religious groups. Such racial prejudice is alive and well. How do you think our nation would fare at the bar of divine judgment based on the judgments announced in Amos? The fact is that the prophetic books, in the prophetic books, the prophets are often very abrasive. And we are not going to really understand them aright unless we're willing, in some sense, to put ourselves within their spotlight. And that's one thing we're called to do when we read these books. So that was just considering these things in light of our nation, as a pagan nation, like these pagan nations that we read about here. But what about ourselves? What about these attitudes in our lives? Matthew 15, 8 through 18 and 19, Jesus says, "But those things which proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and they defile a man. For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies." Think about the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus says that if you lust in your heart, it is like committing adultery. Or if you are angry, it's like committing murder. Are we perhaps in our hearts and in our minds, if not in our actions and sometimes interactions, guilty of some of these things? Do we treat people like things? Or do we justify others who do? Do we use people for our own profit, looking at relationships and friendships for what we can get out of them, rather than honoring the person for who God made him or her to be? Do we break promises if we think it's to our own advantage? The Bible tells us that a righteous man swears to his own hurt. You make a promise, you keep a promise. Even if a better option comes along later, you're faithful to what you promised initially. Do we justify or benefit from cruelty, even if we don't engage in it personally? Are we guilty of ongoing hatred in the form of prejudice against people different from ourselves? Be that for race or for religion or for citizenship status. And I will say, I mean, reading Amos gives me great concern that in our day, political alliances and political expediency often lead God's people into moral compromise in actions, in attitude, and in speech. And again, we need to hear the words of Amos, not only about them back there, but about ourselves in the here and now. The sins of old are the sins of the present, both on national and on personal levels. May we be willing to place ourselves under the spotlight of Amos's prophecy to recognize our three or four transgressions, to recognize them, to repent of them, and to embrace the vision God has always called his people to embrace. Hopefully, our study of this ancient prophetic book will help us to do just that. More next week.